are screaming now. They brought death to hometown, boys. Death to hometown, boys. Death to hometown.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, let's jump right in. The topic today is going to be the yield curve and my prediction of recession late 2019. And we'll get into more deeply what we mean by this yield curve and why it's important and my call of the recession 2019, which I've been making throughout this year, going back to January of this year, 2018. But first, let's follow up a few topics that we've been following here last week that have developed further and are of interest. What I mean is the so-called Huawei affair, and we'll talk about that. Huawei is a Chinese telecom company that's very closely connected to the Chinese government and is a big technology developer, kind of like a Google, you might say. A Google, Microsoft, rolled into one. So we want to mention what that is and, follow up to the oil price deflation problem going on and GM, General Motors, layoffs. Their CEO now is, before Congress committees here and trying to explain its laying off notice of 14,000 workers. And I want to follow up on them because they are important, those three topics, before we get to yield curve and recession. But before all that, just a brief note here on the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics report on jobs and wages today. The wages ticked up a little bit, indicating a 3.1% gain in wages. Well, if you've been following my blog and this show, I've been debunking that figure. Why? Because what does the 3.1% represent? Well, it's not just wages, it's wages and salaries. And salaries mean managers and CEOs and high-level, high-paid, which drags up the average. It's average. The 3.1% is the average, you see. So it's skewed to gains more than 3.1% at the very top, which biases that whole figure. Those at the top, top 10%, are doing well. But if you're using an average, it overestimates when you assume everybody's doing the same. Excuse me. So average is misleading. Also, the figure refers to full-time employed folks, which excludes the roughly 50 million people who are contingent, part-time, temp, and unemployed. And it refers to real wages, in other words, the nominal adjusted for inflation. And that real adjustment is there are problems with that real adjustment. It underestimates inflation for a number of reasons that I've talked about, like overestimating quality adjustments here and chain smoothing of the price increases. And as one of the more notorious sectors, you know, the CPI and these indexes don't include house prices. No, no. Is that in the CPE? No. Consumer Price Index, is that in the PCE? No. Well, how do they account for house prices? Well, they use this phony thing called imputed rents. In other words, the rent factor in the estimation is imputed. It's not an actual rent increase. The home price increase is really an imputed rent increase. What does we mean by imputed rents? An assumption that homeowners pay themselves rent. Yeah, an arbitrary bureaucratic assumption that doesn't change very much over time. And, of course, when we get rising home prices, as recently, it grossly underestimates the contribution to home prices to the indexes, the inflation indexes. So inflation is grossly underestimated, which overestimates wages when you adjust wages for inflation. Right? And also these numbers often include hours. In other words, if you work more hours, your earnings go up, but it gets reported in the press as wages. Well, earnings are not wages. Earnings are wages times the hours worked. And if people are working more hours, more overtime, or taking on second jobs, all that gets reflected in an increase in hours of work that they say wages are rising, but they're really not. The hourly wage is not rising. Okay, so all of those reasons I've talked about before, you can read it on my blog, The Myth of Rising Wages. I think in September, Labor Day, I produced that. JackRasmus.com. Go take a look at that. And it's still being applied here as we get this phony 3% wage increase for, you know, median, mid-level, and below, and even above little workers. You've got the skewed high-end gains, and to some extent, when states raise the minimum wage at the very, very bottom, you got an increase. But the mass in between, the 60 to 80% in between, are just treading water. All right, so that's enough for the BLS wage report. Let's follow up on the trade deal here and this Huawei affair. What do we mean by Huawei? Well, this is this China telecom company that's really a tech company.
Hello.
Right?
Please leave a message.
And what's going on there? Well, the second in charge of the company, in other words, the CFO or the co-chair, I forget, her name is Wang Zhu, visited Canada last weekend and got arrested. The Canadians arrested her on request of the U.S. to extradite her to the United States. Yeah. Here we got this leading company, second in command, a company very close to the Chinese government, by the way, being arrested in Canada on request of the U.S. Well, you know, on the cover of it all, it's ostensibly because of Huawei allegedly dealing with Iran when the U.S. Issued sanctions on Iran. Well, you know, I mean, China's a sovereign country. Does the U.S. have a right simply because it levied sanctions to arrest people of other citizens of other companies, other countries, because they violated U.S. sanctions? Well, when you're the bully of the American global empire, you can do that kind of stuff, I guess. But it's a infringement on sovereignty, and it's even an infringement on sovereignty of Canada. You see, the recent NAFTA deal with Canada had provisions in it that violated Canadian sovereignty because it requires Canada not to negotiate or have dealings with foreign countries with regard to trade, right, that the U.S. doesn't like. That's embedded. That's one of the reasons why Trump wanted to change the trade deal with NAFTA to get greater control over the back door to the U.S. economy through Mexico and Canada for companies that are trying to buy up and get access to U.S. technology. And this is what's behind this Huawei thing. It's the technology fight going on between the U.S. and China. It's over next-generation technology, 5G wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence. That's the crux of the trade fight with China right now, and we'll get to that a little bit more. The hardliners in the U.S. trade negotiations team, specifically the trade representative for Office of U.S. Trade Relations, which is a ambassador level, very important high level position here. His name is Robert Lighthizer. He's been a notorious long-term anti-China hawk. Around him, he has gathered other anti-China hawks like Peter Navarro and John Bolton now, who's a special advisor to Trump. And Navarro is the trade advisor to Trump. This is the hardliner faction. They have friends in Congress, anti-China friends in Congress, and friends in the Pentagon, intelligence agencies, and the military-industrial complex. Okay, so this faction has been dominant here in the U.S. trade negotiations team, right? And the other factions are the U.S. banker multinational factions that just want more access to China markets. And then the farm Midwest manufacturing faction, farm production faction, who want China to buy more goods. Well, over the summer, China conceded, signaled, said, we'll buy $100 billion a year more farm goods from you, U.S. And they also agreed to open their markets to 51% ownership by U.S. Banks and multinational corporations, right? So the two other factions, the farm faction and the banker multinational faction in the U.S. trade team, have already gotten, conceded from China what they want. Ah, but what's holding it up is the technology faction. In other words, concern about technology transfer. And China, of course, is attempting to garner technology from U.S. companies by buying into companies and various financial ways of getting access to U.S. companies and technology and trying to transfer it. And they're doing the same, you know, maybe in Canada and other countries where U.S. companies do business. See, there's a fight over next-generation technologies because they will be the industries of the future and also provide the military dominance of the future. And China has this program called 2025 that it produced here a couple years ago that said it wants to be the leader in these next-gen technologies by 2030. Okay, that caught the attention of the U.S., here. And in 2017, the summer of 2017, Lighthizer's Trade Department issued this scathing report on how China is trying to become dominant in these key technologies and is insisting on U.S. companies in China to share the technology and is trying to send its companies abroad to buy the technology and so forth. It got the attention of the U.S. because of military purposes. You see the connection here between the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex and this faction on the trade team led by Lighthizer. And, of course, that's at the center of this trade deal because the other two factions have gotten what they want from China, but the technology faction has not. China has not agreed to stop its efforts to become the leader, the China 2025. Well, now this brings us back to Huawei, which is a major company on the hunt, you see, for this technology in the U.S., Canada, Europe, and elsewhere. Now, at the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires last weekend, very interesting, by the time the U.S. Trump and the U.S. trade team went into the meeting here with President Xi of China, they had dinner with him, big deal, right? And already this person, Meng Wanzhou, the second leading person in Huawei, had been arrested in Canada. Now, what's really interesting is that Trump this past week said he didn't know anything about the arrest. Ah, but John Bolton, one of the hawks, anti-China hawks, he then admitted he did know. So who's lying here? Is Trump lying that he didn't know? Well, Bolton admits he did know. In other words, the hardline faction is probably behind this arrest of Meng Wanzhou of Huawei in Canada, arrested to be extradited to the U.S. Why did they arrest this person, which they knew would cause a disruption of the trade negotiations and relations? Well, probably because they wanted to make sure that Trump did not agree to anything that did not include the technology issue. Well, as it turned out, there was no agreement, just a lot of happy talk in Buenos Aires at the meeting. But they had this in their back pocket, is my interpretation, prepared maybe to blow up the negotiations if it looked like a deal was being made by Trump, because he's very unpredictable. They don't know if he will or won't. At Buenos Aires, at the G20 meeting. Well, this all comes out here, the arrest the following week, this past week, right? Remember, the Monday after the Buenos Aires meeting, all the talk was, well, we got this tremendous agreement here with the Chinese on trade, and Trump, of course, puffs it all up as he typically does, makes it look like it's more than it was. The Chinese first don't say anything because obviously there wasn't any agreement. Causes the stock market to boom because it looks like there's no trade war coming. But then when the truth comes out, there's no there there. There was no agreement, really, just happy talk. Well, then the stock market collapses 800 points the next day because this trade war is beginning to bite. And if it went through in 2019, if the trade war really erupted, then it would really have a much greater impact on the farm sector and other sectors of trade in the U.S. You see, we're not really at a trade war yet. Really, you have $50 billion of tariffs imposed by both sides here in July, and then Trump imposed another $200 billion in September, but said it was only 10%. And there was a 10% tariff on $200 billion more, but that it might go to 25% in January 2019. Well, if it were allowed to go to 25%, well, that would be the eruption of the true trade war, because the 10% has not really affected China, because China's currency has depreciated at least by 10% over the summer. So it's been a push, you see. And the markets knew this, and business knows this. That's why they're getting antsy about a trade war, but not really acting as if there were one. But January would have been the deadline. Well, coming out of the G20, Trump concedes that, okay, we won't raise the tariff from 10 to 25% on January. We'll talk for another 90 days. But he puts Lighthizer in charge of the negotiations with the Chinese, right? Well, it's going to be hardline over technology. And my guess is there's not going to be an agreement after 90 days with China because of Lighthizer and the hardliners still running U.S. tech and trade negotiations, you see. I could be wrong. If the U.S. economy weakens significantly in 2019, which I think it will, and I think in a winter quarter, typically it always looks worse than it is. Excuse me, recovering from a cold. If it looks worse than it is, then, maybe Trump will back off and will support the Mnuchin farm factions instead of the hardliners, and try to get some kind of an agreement for the sake of the economy. Okay, well, we will see to what extent we get this shift, if we get one. If not, the impression of a trade war being imminent will increase. If there's no agreement by the end of February, the 90-day, things may get worse. They'll probably just extend the discussions. In the meantime, the U.S. will continue its fight company by company on the tech issue. In other words, the Huawei's, there'll be more Huawei's that it will go after. It will put more pressure on U.S. allies, as it's already doing with the U.K. and Europe, to also block Huawei. This is just in a long apparent trend here, Huawei's only the latest. Before it was ZTE Corp, Chinese corporation, in the spring, and before that, Broadcom, a quasi-Chinese corporation, that the U.S. was going after. So you'll see more, while negotiations are pending and continuing, you will see more U.S. offenses against Chinese company by company. Okay, so very interesting here, this Huawei deal. China's initial response was to be very angry about it, but then it moderated its response. If you read the Chinese press, it moderated its response. Why? Well, I think because China's whole strategy has been to appeal to the Mnuchin and farm factions with major concessions that it's made so that it doesn't have to concede on the technology issues. And they've been courting Mnuchin and the farm group quite a bit here ever since May. You know, Mnuchin thought he had an agreement. He went over to Beijing and he came back and said, "We got an agreement." Well, that's when the hardliners stepped in and got Trump on their side, and they squashed the agreement. they're back to the bargaining table, and then they started raising, Trump and others started raising and implementing tariffs, the $50 billion, the $200 billion, and China responded with $50 billion and $60 billion, and that's where we're at right now. But Trump made major concessions at the G20 meeting, not just not raising the tariffs from 10 to 25%, but he also agreed that he's going to stop and not move on another $267 billion tariffs on China, which would have meant all of Chinese goods tariffed at 25%, which would have caused a sharp drop. Okay, he says, "I'm a tariff man." He likes tariffs. Well, the problem with tariffs is the strategy that everybody can do it. You know, it's like, you know, everyone's got a nose. You know, if you raise tariffs, I can do it too. The U.S. is believe that China cannot raise tariffs as much because we buy far more goods from them than they do from us. Well, but China has other tactics that it can use as well, like not slowing its purchase of U.S. treasuries, launching anti-U.S. boycotts, making U.S. business in China, making U.S. business more difficult to do business in China. Lots of things it can do short of raising tariffs. Well, we're not at a trade war yet, and it's been put off for 90 days. Call this a trade spat, skirmish, fight. But it could erupt after 90 days. We'll see. In the meantime, we got these things like Huawei going on, which will continue. And they're an indication that the hardliners aligned with the U.S. Pentagon and military-industrial complex are really in the driver's seat on the U.S. team right now. Excuse me again. Okay. I think the key will be whether the U.S. economy and global economy continues to slow significantly. You know, if there's a fight over NAFTA 2.0 in Congress, which has to approve the Trump deal here with NAFTA, and maybe the Mueller indictment comes out, who knows? You know, China's playing a long game. It's continuing to try to court the other two factions and playing a long game and hoping that they will win out. And a lot depends on who has Trump's ear, which is notorious short-term. But right now it's the hardliners have his ear. Okay. The other thing I want to make a comment on here is global oil prices. We talked about those last week, right? Deflation going on big time. Three big players in that, U.S. shale producers, Saudi Arabia and Russia, each of which has over 10 million barrels a day, that 10 million barrels that it produces. And the U.S., of course, shale producers are pumping more and more because they need to ensure the revenue to pay off these high cost, high yield bond debt, junk bond debt that they've incurred in all the drilling that's coming due. So they're not going to cut their production. And right now, Saudi Arabia is trying to get its OPEC allies to cut the production and get Russia to go along with it. Well, the latest is that the Saudis have an agreement of sorts within OPEC where Saudi will shoulder two-thirds of the cut, the production cuts, to drive the price back up, and the other OPEC players will shoulder one-third. Well, there's a resistance to that within OPEC because this problem is really caused by Saudi Arabia. You see, over the summer, the U.S. levied sanctions on Iran designed to prevent Iran from selling its oil, among other things. And the Saudis thought they were going to scoop up all that excess oil demand here that the Iran had and steal it for themselves, you see, steal that market share. So they pumped up their production, their output. The Saudis did. 1 million barrels. They pumped their production by 1 million barrels over the summer. And of course, that meant that Russia just increased its production. The U.S. continued to increase its production. And we got a massive oversupply of oil out there that caused the price by September, October to implode, the oil price. So the Saudis were behind the problem, and of course the Trump administration was behind it as well. They levied the sanctions on Iran, and then they exempted it, you see. And so Iran kept pumping its oil, and Saudi increased its oil, and Russia and the U.S. Well, that's why you got this crash going on. So the Saudis are trying to make the rest of the OPEC shoulder the burden of the problem it caused, you see, and they're not too happy with that. And the Russians are playing coy. They're not agreeing yet. They probably will, but it'll be token agreement. It won't stop the oil price collapse because the demand side of the price collapse is getting worse as the global economy slows. Okay. Okay, so we'll see. Right now they're meeting in Vienna, and it doesn't look good. Oil prices are continuing to decline. If you're interested in this topic, on my blog of a couple weeks ago is a feature article entitled Global Oil Price Deflation 2018, around the middle of November. So take a look at that if you're particularly interested in global oil prices, and you should be, because global oil is a key financial asset, and if its price deflates, it to some extent will drag down other financial asset markets. It's already having some effect on stock markets globally. You see, all these these financial asset markets are linked globally, and the same people invest in all of them, the global shadow bankers. And they move from asset to asset market. And if asset prices are falling, they move out of it. And they may just move to the sideline on other asset prices, which is happening. Okay. Last preliminary comment here, the GM layoffs. Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, has been testifying before Congress. And Congress is kind of, at least the Democrats, are a little pissed off here because GM was given $80 billion bailout, and it was just now given another 20% profit boost with the Trump tax cuts. In other words, we've been subsidizing GM for a long time, and GM takes the money, and what do they do with it? They invest in Mexico and elsewhere. And Congress is a little PO'd over the fact that they took some of this money, and they're investing it, particularly tax cuts, and they're expanding production in Mexico. Well, wait a minute. Wasn't NAFTA 2.0 supposed to, the USMCA, Trump, that you know, puffed and boasted about. Wasn't that supposed to stop the movement of jobs to Mexico? Well, as I said, that's all smoke and mirrors. That's all false spin and marketing for the press and the public. So, you know, GM moves to Mexico. Well, what's behind the 14,000 layoffs at this time as GM moves its factory to Mexico? This is the one of the main factories is the Lordstown, Ohio factory shutting down. I think four or five factories were shut down in the U.S. while it's expanding in Mexico. Well, what's behind the 14,000 layoffs? I think this is a strategy by GM to pressure Congress for further concessions as the global and U.S. sales of autos begin to slow, turn down, which is happening. It's a way to soften up the auto workers union for negotiations, I think, coming up next year as well, right? what is GM attempting to get out of Congress out of this? Well, it's turning towards more electric car production over the next decade, and there's a provision, legal provision, in the electric car credits, you know, $7,500, you buy electric car, which the auto companies then simply raise the price of their cars in order to absorb that credit, you see. That's really a subsidy for the auto companies themselves, that's $7,500. Well, there's a limit to that. There's a quota for each model that they can, you know, the dealerships can offer the $7,500. Well, if GM and others are going to increase their output, they're going to exceed that quota of electric cars. So GM is maneuvering, lobbying to get that quota increased or eliminated, right? And this is a threat, you know. I don't think they're going to lay those 14,000 off. This is a bargaining chip to get that change, and also to push Trump to levy a 25% increase in tariffs on foreign auto imports to the U.S. You see, that's been bubbling there, but because most of these foreign imports come from Europe and Japan, Trump has not pushed that yet while he conducted his, quote, trade deals with NAFTA and with China here. Rather than fight on three and four fronts, he's decided to fight on a couple. Well, you know, why is the auto companies pushing for that? Well, if you increase the tariffs 25%, that means that there's going to be less sales in the U.S. by foreign competition, right? And it allows GM to raise the price on its autos without being undercut by a lower price by foreign competition. The tariff will keep the foreign competition raising their price, you see, effectively. So it's a ploy very similar to what the steel companies did with the steel tariffs. You know, since last March, we've had these 25% tariffs on incoming steel, which has allowed the steel companies to raise prices 22%. The tariffs have not increased steel employment or gotten the steel companies to build new plants to hire more people. No, no. It's been the cover for them to raise their prices and their profits by 22%. Well, you know, this has worked for steel. The auto companies are looking at the same thing, saying, well, why can't we do that, right? Why can't we get Trump to raise tariffs on autos 25% so we can raise our price? Because, you know, we're not selling as much of these cars. It's turning down, and that means we have less revenue and less profits from volume sales. Well, let's try to raise profits with price. You see, there's three ways to get profits, right? You just sell more of the stuff that you got. All right. Or you raise prices on what you got. Sometimes you can raise prices and even though you sell less, you can still increase your profits. Or you cut costs. Well, these strategies by GM are aimed at all the above, you see. cut labor costs, attack the UAW Auto Workers Union, raise prices with the cover of tariffs, right, and get a subsidy on your sales by extending the electric car credit quotas. All right, so this is what's going on here, right? Okay, we'll see what happens. All right, so let's turn to the main topic here today, and that is the yield curve and recession 2019. All right, the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates here, and I've been saying since the beginning, actually late last year, that the Fed cannot raise rates four times in the U in 18 and four more times in 2019. The federal funds rate, that's the benchmark rate. It's a short-term rate, right? But why is the Fed raising rates?
Mr. Chairman, well, distinguished members of the committee.
Well, what was that? Someone's interrupting me. Anyway, why is the Fed raising rates? Well, it's raising rates in order to fund the deficit, you see. Trump's $1 trillion-a-year deficit because of his massive tax cuts and his defense spending increases. We got a $1 trillion deficit every year. Well, it's the Federal Reserve that sells the bonds that brings in the cash to cover the deficit. So the Fed is raising rates, I believe, in order to do just that. It has nothing to do with slowing inflation, you see. That's what they say to the public. Well, we got to raise rates to control inflation. Right? Well, you got inflation less than 2%. So why are they raising rates if inflation is not above 2%, according to them? You know, that's just a fiction that the Fed raises rates in order to control or prevent inflation. The Fed is raising rates for two reasons here. Well, actually three, I think. One, to fund the federal deficit. Two, raising rates increases banks' profits. It increases their spread and it allows them to increase their profits. And also, I think the Fed is raising rates to get a little cushion here for the next recession they know is coming. So those are the real reasons why Fed rate hikes are going on. But the Fed cannot raise those rates, I believe, above 2.75. You know, the federal funds rate's at 2.25. I've been saying one, maybe two more at the most hikes, because after 2.75 of that very short-term federal funds rate, you start getting a credit crunch and liquidity problems, and thus a recession. So if the federal funds rate's at 2.25 now, one more rate will bring it to 2.5 here, and we're going to get that in December, and I'm saying maybe one more in March, and that's it. Well, you know, the press and the business press and economists for quite some time have been saying, no, it's going to be much more than that. Well, the business press and economists are coming around now because the market doesn't believe that the Fed's going to be able to raise rates four more times next year. Well, most mainstream economists are still going along with that, but they're totally irrelevant. They don't know what the hell's going on. The markets have a better idea of what's going on in that sense, right? So let's talk about the yield curve, right? The yield curve has to do with federal funds and interest rate, the Fed raising interest rates. You see, when the Fed raises the federal funds rate, the benchmark rate, it drives up other interest rates. It drives up treasury bills, the 2-year, the 3-year, the 5-year bond rates, the 10-year bond rate, and the 30-year treasury bond rate, right? They all follow that federal funds rate. Now, the yield curve, why is it important? And what is it? All right, for those who aren't too sure, yield is the terminology that's used in relation to bonds that really means the interest rate on the bonds. Okay, that's the yield. The 2-year yield is the interest rate on the 2-year bond, 10-year, 30, the same. Okay, now what's a curve? A curve is just the line. Actually, the yield curve is two lines. And one line is usually above the other line, and the distance between the two is called the spread. No, the spread between the 2-year bond rate and, let's say, the 10-year bond rate might be a couple percents of interest, right? And if that spread between the short term and the long term rates, usually long term rates are higher than short term rates. If the spread, the distance between the two, converge, in other words, there's no spread, then we say the curve has flattened. And sometimes we find the long-term rate, which should be always above the short-term, dipping below the short-term rate. That's called inversion of the yield curve, right? Where the trend line of the short-term rises equal to the long-term trend. And let's say, for example, the 2-year rate and the 10-year bond rate are equivalent. Then we have a flattening of the space between. We have a flattening of the curves. And when the short-term rises above the long-term, we have an inversion. Why is that? How does that happen? Well, the Federal Reserve Central Bank, only influences really the short-term rates. It has very little influence over long-term rates. Long-term rates are more a function of the economy and the global economy, right? If the global economy is slowing, which it is, right, the long-term rates will start to come down because the demand for dollars, declines. If the demand declines, the price will decline. And it has to do with global economic conditions influencing the demand and the price of the bonds. And therefore, if the price of the bonds go up, for example, the rate will go down. The price and the yield or the rate always move in opposite directions with the bonds. So long-term, the bond rates tend to come down as the global economy weakens and the U.S. economy weakens. And if this occurs at the same time that the Fed is raising rates to pay for deficits and cushions and whatever, right, then the two will converge, right? And if the two converge, that's an indication that the Fed is raising rates too much. If the short term rises above the long term, the Fed is, in other words, overcorrecting, because the economy is really weaker than the Fed thinks it is. Now, this is important because ever since 1975, every time we've had a flattened yield, every recession has been associated with a flattening or inverting of the yield curve. And it doesn't have to invert very much, you see. Every recession since 75, right, has been associated with a yield curve flattening or worse. Now, there are a few cases where you've had a flattening and didn't get a recession. That's quite different. Okay. So let's talk about the inversion or the flattening going on. We already have an inversion in the 2, 3-year, and 5-year, 2 to 5 and 3 to 5 year. We already have an inversion. That's got the attention of financial markets. They think, oh, is this an indicator of a recession that's pending? And we have a flattening of the curve between the 10 and the 2-year bond rates. They are flattening. They haven't inverted yet. The spread's getting narrow. How narrow is it? Well, only what's called 10 or 12 basis points. A basis point is 1/100th of 1%. Okay, so 10 basis points is 1/10th of 1%. Well, that's a pretty narrow, almost flattened curve between the 10 and the 2-year bond rates. Again, the 2, 3, and the 5 have already flattened and inverted. And we're darn close to an inversion of the 10 and the 2. Now, that's the typical curve that's looked at. Obviously, you could have different curves depending on which bond rates that you select, right? You could have a 35 and a 10-2, a 10-5, you know, whatever. You can even have T-bills, which are 90 days, a 5-year and a 90-day T-bill, whatever. But the traditional one is the 10-year T-bond and the 2-year, and that's about 10 basis points. Now, I predicted this back in January and then again in June. I said by year-end, the yield curve between the 10 and the 2 would flatten. Go listen to some of my interviews on my blog, jackrasmus.com, last June, and read some of my comments on Fed and recession coming here going back to January, 12 months ago. So it's signaling the red flags are rising. That recession is coming in the U.S. Now, mainstream economists who don't forecast the future, they forecast the present safely, to be safe, you know, are just going along with the consensus that there'll be 4 more rate hikes. Well, there won't be. There won't be in 2019. The market knows this. And now some of the finance research arms of the big banks are coming around as well, and other business economists coming around saying, no, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to get 4. No, because housing is already slowing. All the indicators, housing starts, new sales, the old sales, orders, et cetera. Housing is already, always slips first into recession where we were. And I hope that the audience is being able to hear here and is not getting an overlay. All right, we're still talking about the U.S. recession. The yield curve is signaling a recession, especially if we get an inversion of the 10-2 curve. Housing is down. Autos are down. Real business investment has been slowing. And corporate bonds, leverage industrial loans are slowing. This is all an indication that business is reconsidering its expansion here, right? Okay. Will the Fed continue raising rates? Well, Morgan Stanley says no. Morgan Stanley Bank Research, right, says that, in fact, it's calling for a recession in 2019, the first one to call for that, along with myself. Okay. As I've been saying for quite some time, the Fed can't raise its federal funds rate above 2.75, which is two hikes of a 0.25% here. I believe we're going to see in the winter quarter as well, a typical underestimation of growth. The U.S. is having problems with seasonality adjustments, and the winter quarter always comes in much lower, and the summer quarters much higher than they actually are in terms of GDP. And that will have a psychological effect. If the first quarter of next year GDP is exceptionally low, that will have a psychological effect, feedback effect, that will exacerbate the problem. Right. Continued federal fund rate hikes, 4% next year, will also cause too much global instability. If the rates rise, the value of the dollar rises, causes emerging market currencies to collapse, capital flight, and problems there in their markets, and the recessions are provoked. That's already happened. And that will deepen if the Fed continues raising rates, and I don't think it will, in part for that reason. We've got the European Union and the UK slowing. Germany contracted briefly there 1 month. The UK looks like it moving towards some sort of a crisis with the Brexit. That will certainly throw it into recession. Predictions are Italy will be in recession. So Italy, UK, and a few other major economies will make sure that Europe is in recession next year. Japan has already entered another recession. So these global instability forces will influence the Fed and its decision as well. If we can have continued rate hikes, right, the dollar will continue to go up, which will complicate Trump's tariff wars here, because if you levy tariffs on the opponents and then you allow your dollar to appreciate, to rise, you've just negated and offset the tariffs that you've levied. So it's working, the rate hikes are working against the tariffs, you see. And that's another reason why tariffs are not a good weapon here in trade relations. But Trump, he says, I'm a tariff man, right? He doesn't probably understand the complexities here that these programs provoke. Right? Now, critics of the yield curve say, it's only inverted at the low end, the 2, 3, and 5 year, right? Roughly 2.71. Both. But the short term bleeds into the long term, you see. And as I said, we're only 10 basis points or so away from the 10-2 inversion. Okay. Recession 2019, I think we're on the trajectory for it in the second half. Right? Global trade is slowing. I've talked about Germany, EU, UK, Japan, Italy, right? Global oil prices are deflating and will continue. There won't be a significant successful deal between Russia and Saudi propping up those prices, as those global oil prices, which are oil options futures, which are a financial asset, continue to decline. It will have a psychological effect on investors and bleed into, exacerbate financial asset markets declining. The trade war thing here not likely to be resolved in 90 days will have a further negative effect on U.S. financial asset markets, right? In real terms, the tariffs are beginning to hit the U.S. farm sector. It recently just came out that a study showed that in Nebraska alone, it's caused $1 billion loss in farm production and sales. $1 billion just in Nebraska, right? The U.S. economy itself has been showing various signs of slowing, as I said, housing, autos. We just had factory orders showing a problem here for the first time last month, right? The jobs data that came out today was at 160,000 jobs created, whereas the moving average has been well over 200,000. This is just the tip, the beginning, right? Downward revisions for previous months is an indication of softening on the job front, right? A beginning short uptick in unemployment insurance filings is another indication that the turn has been made in the employment markets. With this $1 trillion deficits here coming next year, obviously we're going to see an attack on government spending, which has been one of the major areas keeping up the economy this year, and the Trump tax cuts. Some say won't have as much effect next year on the real economy. It has a large effect on financial asset and stock buybacks. That's where most of the money's been going from the tax cuts. Business inventories and real investment has been slowing. Inventories rising. These are all converging, early signals converging. I believe if they continue, will grow in magnitude and begin impacting other sectors of the economy as well in 2019. My call has always been second half of 2019, we will slip into recession in the U.S. And we may already be in recession in Europe by then. We're already in Japan. China keeps slowing. Asset markets, financial asset markets are beginning to contract here, decline everywhere, will have an effect on investor psychology and investment trends, the trade war, which will likely increase in intensity after February of next year, because I don't see the Chinese agreeing to back off of its next-gen technology development, and neither will the U.S. I think the hardline faction in the U.S., the Lighthizers, Boltons, Navarros, they would rather have no agreement than go after these companies one by one than to have an agreement with China that doesn't cover the new generation technologies. In other words, they, if necessary, will scuttle the negotiations. And, you know, the Huawei event where Bolton knew about it but Trump didn't, you know, is an indication that they're playing hardball. And they're going around Trump. Okay, so that's it for today. My apologies for any disruptions here and for my my medical condition. And next week, we're going to talk about next week the growing concerns and reports about growing instability in the global economy.